Gary Knoll, and you're listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, three separate topics. The first topic, the role of the International Monetary Fund in U.S. foreign developmental policies. Who does it really serve? My guest from Washington, D.C. in the first segment will be Dr. Mark Weisbrot, W-E-I-S-B-R-O-T. Dr. Weisbrot is co-director with Dean Baker for the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. They specialize in domestic and international economic policy and U.S. economic relations with Latin America. He writes a weekly column for The Guardian Unlimited in the U.K. and is a frequent contributor on economic policy to the McClatchy News Services and Brazil's largest newspaper. Mark is also president of Just Foreign Policy, an independent nonprofit organization dedicated to reforming U.S. policy based upon diplomacy, cooperation, and international law. He has a Ph.D. in economics from the University of Michigan, and he co-wrote the screenplay with Tariq Ali for Oliver Stone's film South of the Border, after leftist governments in Latin America. His organization's website, where you can find his writings, is cepr.org. From there, we will be going to an open call for those who have something constructive to share on the two-hour original investigative report I did last Monday evening on the future of Pacifica and specifically WBAI. Following the broadcast, which had the largest audience in the history of the Progressive Commentary Hour for a live show, I was inundated with people who, from multiple regimes in different stations over the decades, came forward with their input, information, and a trove of documents, many of them very important legal documents, that would allow a more open, a transparent, and a more honest and objective look at how did Pacifica become the most, go from the most important voice of progressive ideals and policies to virtually irrelevant, with no audience. That was in that information. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to set aside time for those who wish to share something of a constructive nature. You can call in after this segment and share that. Then, concerning all the different commentaries that are not shared by the mainstream media in any depth, today, thousands of workers exploited as greedy universities grab petrodollars to globalize and corporatize. We recently heard about New York University President John Sexton's decided the risk the university's was facing as far as a reputation for petrodollars maybe wasn't worth it. Well, that's after the university was completely built. He's not alone. All these major universities that are now in Dubai and the United Arab Emirates and Qatar and Abu Dhabi, that's after hundreds of thousands of workers have been exploited and are still being exploited. Also, endless war, five disturbing things in America's military budget. Then, no longer an inner-city problem, today's typical harem users are white, upper-middle-class people living in the suburbs. And then, new laws facilitating privatization of the U.S. water systems. And if time permits, five top similarities and practices between big tobacco and big pharma. They share so many commonalities in the industry practices that it's quite difficult to deny their ideological similarities. Besides, the fact that both have used medical doctors to push their products, and I'll give you specific examples. These are all important issues. We'll get to them in our final commentary segment, time permitting. Let's now go to Washington, D.C. and say hello to Dr. Mike Weisbrot. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Gary. Great to be here.
Right now, we have a case example brewing in the Ukraine on how the International Monetary Fund operates its loans to nations based on austerity conditions. Now, we've witnessed this before in many countries where developing nations fall into continual debt to pay off the International Monetary Fund interest while cutting back on important national programs and job forces, even subsidies like food and fuel to their local populations just to meet the International Monetary Fund demands. In the Ukraine, here's a situation where a loan would be given, and yet, as has been noted, the International Monetary Fund itself anticipates the country's economy will shrink by 5% during the loan period. Yet, as we witnessed in Greece, there is no assurance that these loans will stimulate a recovery and might not ultimately prolong and worsen recessions. So first, would you please, using the Ukraine as a current example, or another country if you feel it is a more important example, of how the International Monetary Fund, which unfortunately is held in high regard, but with very little understanding of how it actually works, how it functions.
Yes. Well, the IMF is officially a 190-nation member organization, but it's run by an executive board where the United States has a veto, and the United States, together with Europe and a couple of other high-income countries, generally decides. So, you know, for countries like in Africa and poor countries that still go to the IMF, they don't really have that much of a voice. Now, for Europe, it's a little different because the European directors will decide for Europe. And for a country like Ukraine, unfortunately for the Ukrainians, it's also the European directors and the United States together deciding what's going to happen with their economy. So Ukraine's a good example because this is a transitional time for Ukraine. They had a coup, as probably a lot of your listeners know, and the elected government was overthrown. And the elected government was not a good government, but on the economic policy, it was trying to basically respond somewhat to the electorate in the sense that they wanted to keep the economy growing and keep employment at a reasonable level. And they were running into some trouble because, after all, you know, Europe has had a terrible two recessions in the last few years. And so, and of course, Russia was slowing, and that's about a quarter of their exports, and most good part of the rest go to Europe. So they needed some help, and the government was trying to, play off the U.S. against Russia, that is to try and get some help from either side and not go into one camp or the other necessarily. And they found they couldn't do that because the Western powers especially said that if you go to Russia for a loan, which Russia offered a $15 billion loan without any conditions, any economic policy conditions, and they said if you went to them, you know, you wouldn't, not only be cut off from Europe, but then, of course, there was this movement in the western part of the country that, as you all know, overthrew the government. So what happens now is the Western powers who supported the coup and put, you know, billions of dollars into Ukraine over the last 20 years to achieve this result, they get to decide what the economic future of the country is because they have a what's called a standby arrangement, a loan agreement with the IMF that they signed just at the end of April. And that spells out what economic policy is going to be for Ukraine for at least the next couple of years. And what's it going to be? As you mentioned, a recession this year, a very deep one, a 5% decline. And they say it's going to recover next year, but that's doubtful. And they're going to try to restructure the economy in the same ways that they, you know, restructured other economies, which means permanently higher or indefinitely higher unemployment. They're going to cut the energy subsidies, which do have to be cut some, but again, they're going to do it in a kind of not very careful way, so they may lose industry, like part of their steel industry or their other industries that are dependent on relatively cheap energy could take a hit. A lot of people in those industries could be unemployed, and you don't know how far down the economy goes. I mean, look at Greece. they ended up with 6 years of recession under IMF agreements, which is incredible. I mean, that's really a depression, and 27% unemployment. And there's a number of other examples in the Eurozone. So the question is, how far are they going to push the economy of Ukraine down before it's able to recover? And what's going to be left of it in terms of employment, social protections, health care, pensions, and things like that when it finally does recover?
Thank you for that answer. I've been to Jamaica many times, and one of the last times I visited it, there was a discussion about should they accept money from the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. The question was, did they need the money? Yes, but it's what came with it, structural adjustment. And for those who are not familiar with structural adjustment, it seems reasonable. Well, in order to help you get out of this mess you're in, you're going to have to cut back a lot of these subsidies that you're giving people, and you're going to have to get more people to pay taxes, and it goes forward. But there's another hidden side to it, and that is most of the money that ends up going from the World Bank, certainly because I've spoken with one of the top executives there, doesn't actually go to the country nor to the people. It goes to international, very well-connected private industries, an engineering company, an architect company, someone that will build a dam, an electro-hydro company, make roads that do not serve the people, but only a way of transporting whatever's being exploited back to a port, even the development of ports, which then gets tacked on to the bill. And the Prime Minister of Jamaica at the time, a man named Manley, said, we run a great risk here because even though we're poor, we are at least self-sustaining. Now, if you've ever gone through Jamaica, especially through the heartland, you'll notice that there are thousands upon thousands of small to medium-sized farms. The temperature allows them to grow 12 months a year, and they generally do cooperative work, meaning I'll grow bananas, you grow split peas, we'll share them. And the farmers' markets there were the envy of the Caribbean. They made the mistake of accepting the terms. Immediately, we started to see Clinton work with the farm groups in the United States and major big agra, and suddenly potatoes could no longer be grown in Jamaica because they'd pull up in a truck and they would give Idaho potatoes at half the cost of a Jamaican potato. Dairies closed down all over the island because suddenly the dairy was coming in the non-fat dry milk powders half the cost of a local dairy. And so it went across all this. And finally, the last subsidy to go was bananas. In fact, there was a large number of people working in banana farms in Jamaica, but now they made it so that not even bananas that had been protected under a special treaty with England could be contained. And so they went through one of the most devastating downturns. That led to increased drugs, crime, and the destruction of their self-sufficiency. Clinton has never taken responsibility. He did the same thing, by the way, with Haiti, where they may have been poor, but at least they grew an awful lot of food, so much food for 10 years they could actually export it. And yet we never, in the American media, we never actually hold it up at a scorecard. Here's what money you got. Here's who it went to. Here are the actual people that got it. Here's the compounding interest if you don't pay it back. And here's the private industries that now own your industries, own your essential gas, tolls, water. Why don't we ever look at this part of the equation in our society to see the truth of the International Monetary Fund's very heavy hand on these people?
Yes, well, I mean, you mentioned Jamaica and especially, you know, some of the earlier history, but even more recently, the IMF has been involved in a terrible way. We did our last update last year on the Jamaican economy, and at that time, the IMF was projecting that the Jamaican economy wouldn't even reach its 2007, that is, pre-crisis level of per capita income, its income per person. They wouldn't even be there in 2017. And Jamaica has, at this point, the highest interest payments as a percent of their economy in the entire world. Their debt service takes up about 50% of total budgeted expenditures, and health and education over the last 4 years combined have been about 20%. It's an unbelievable debt burden. And, of course, it wouldn't be tolerated anywhere else. I mean, Greece, they were at least forced, the creditors were forced to take a haircut, even though Greece still has a very high level of debt. The, you know, the interest as percent of debt is not even, it's maybe half of what it is in Jamaica as a percentage of the Greek economy. So this is a debt level that nobody should ever have to pay, and they're never going to have any development there in order, you know, if they keep paying this level of debt. And if you look at the past, you know, you look at the you know, just from, say, 93 to 2007, before the Great Recession, the economy grew per person at about 0.4% a year, which is, you know, terrible for a developing country, and doesn't really give a whole generation any chance to improve its living standards. So here, this is a case where the IMF, and that means in Jamaica, the IMF really means the U.S. Treasury Department, because again, the European directors not really care. They aren't really caring about what happens in so much in this hemisphere. They leave that to the United States. And so the IMF, the U.S. Treasury Department, is making these decisions with, of course, Jamaica's other creditors and their private creditors, and making a decision to keep them in a not only an unsustainable debt, but an unsustainable debt that really is the worst in the entire world, and they're never going to be able to pay. And all they're going to do is squeeze them for years and years, squeeze the economy, and then at some point, of course, there will be a default or a restructuring, but it'll be very late. It'll be after they've sacrificed, you know, two, three decades of economic development.
But we never tell the truth. We never tell how much interest governments make off this debt. And also, we don't give these people any choice frequently. We demand that they take this debt because we put it in the... Look at poor Haiti. I can't tell you how many people I know from Haiti, including developmental workers and NGOs and citizens, people close to the president who I know, and they all say the same thing. $9 out of every $10 that's supposed to go down there after President Clinton goes there goes to private interest, not the Haitian people, and it's always been this way.
Yes, and it's even worse than that in Haiti, because in Jamaica, you can say, well, you know, the government of Jamaica goes along with this, and they're being pressured and they're being coerced. But if they wanted to, if you had a strong government that had the backing of people, they could do what Argentina did in, you know, the end of 2001. They could default on their debt, say goodbye to the IMF, and, you know, Argentina did very well. And in Jamaica's case, they would get help, too, from some of the left governments in Latin America. So there is always a choice, you know. But in Haiti, you could say that the people made that choice several times, and that's where the United States government, together with Canada and France, used actual military force to prevent them from having an elected government. And the first time was the first time in the last 20-something years, that is. Obviously, you can go back to 1930s when the Marines invaded the country. But if you just look at recent history, in 1991, the CIA helped overthrow the elected government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who, again, was elected on a platform to help pull Haiti out of poverty. And he was overthrown, and they killed thousands of people, his supporters, and instituted a dictatorship. And then finally, after 3.5 years in exile here in Washington, President Clinton actually put him back because the Black Caucus here forced him to. And that was a time when the Congressional Black Caucus was much stronger than it is today. And then they overthrew him again, this time in broad daylight, in 2004. The United States just put him on a rendition plane and took him out of the country to Africa. And so, and of course, the elections since then, they don't allow the largest political party in the country to even run in the election. So this is a case where the people already know enough and are willing to take the risk and have risked their lives many times and lost, taken a lot of casualties to have a government that would stand up to the foreign powers and to the IMF and would chart a different path. And in this case, you can see that the United States and its allies resort to direct violence to get the government that they want.
As an aside here, I believe that we might examine briefly the World Bank, because people confuse the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, how they're different, and who do they both serve? Do they serve Wall Street? Do they serve neocon developmental strategies? I know people like Professor Michael Chofskodosky, who take the very unpopular view that these two institutions primarily serve the large multinational banking firms. Your thoughts on this?
Well, they do to a certain extent. I wouldn't put it exactly like that, because I think in the United States case, which is the dominant power in both of those institutions, they put their strategic interests first, their empire kind of interests. And sometimes those are the same as the corporate interests, but sometimes they're not. And so, for example, you know, you have the case of Argentina, for example, where, you know, they were looking more to have power over Argentina than they were to collect the debt for the banks, you know. In Jamaica, yeah, Jamaica's weak, and they don't, you know, there you could say they're operating for the banks to a certain extent by forcing them to pay back this unpayable debt. But for the most part, they're really, the corporate interests are there, and you can see them in the World Bank a lot, because the World Bank will, you know, has a whole division of the World Bank that specializes in these public-private ventures, and they're working very directly with corporate interests on infrastructure and, water and things like that, and even oil, fossil fuel development. But I think the bank does most of its damage by making most of its lending conditional on the same conditions as the IMF. In other words, like Ukraine is a perfect example, actually. The World Bank is kicking in, I think, $3 billion into this latest effort going on right now, which is quite a bit, actually, and for an economy the size of Ukraine. And that's just more clout for the IMF and the Western powers. It's another $3 billion where they'll have to follow those conditions that could wreck the economy over the next couple of years and restructure it in a way that will make it more unequal and more difficult for the majority of people. So that's where I think the World Bank does its damage. Now, they have different missions, you know, officially, and this is true. I mean, the IMF makes kind of stabilization kind of loans. So the country is running a balance of payments deficit. They need foreign currency that go to the IMF, you know. And the World Bank, in general, is making loans that are more for projects and for development. And so that's the division of labor. But the problem is that they're both controlled by the same group of people, for the most part. And that's and so they will enforce the overall conditions together. Now, I will say that there has been a change at the bank. You know, Jim Kim is the first, practically the only, World Bank president that isn't either a private, didn't come as from a career as a private banker or a war criminal, quite literally, in, you know, to be president of the World Bank. And he took over a couple of years ago, and I think he has tried to make some reforms there, and it's really hard to tell, for me at least, without really investigating it, how much he's been able to do.
Okay, I have one last question for you, and that is that we, the United States, set the example for what we expect the rest of the world to do as far as financial reasonableness and to keep yourself in balance financially, and yet we have been giving between $80 and $100 billion a month through quantitative easing. It's total over $23 trillion, to about 22, mainly to 22 different institutions. The average American has nothing to show for this. It hasn't stopped small businesses from going out of business, hasn't stopped, hasn't helped the student loan debacle or the interest on credit cards or home foreclosures. And yet, why isn't it that we are held up for our poor financial accountability? Because if you look at how much we actually owe, how much money is printed and given to financial institutions that do not support America's growth, but only their own, and how much our unfunded and underfunded entitlements are, we would be the basket case of the world. Why aren't we ever held to account?
Well, I agree with you that there's a lot that this government could do with that money at the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve created about $2.3 trillion since 2008, and that's money that is just created, and a lot of people think that that causes inflation, but it doesn't. Inflation is still very low, so there's really no problem with creating that money. It just, you know, as you suggested, it would be a lot better if that money were used to do some things that this economy really needs. And one, to create jobs, and two, to improve our infrastructure, make it more energy efficient. There's, you know, public transportation. There's all kinds of things we could do to reduce climate change. And so this is not the best use of the money. The way they have done it, of course, they've created the money just for the purpose of keeping long-term interest rates lower. And, of course, that's still a lot better than nothing. I mean, this economy would be a lot worse if it were not for the quantitative easing and the money creation that we're talking about. If you don't believe it, all you have to do is look at Europe, where their unemployment is almost twice the level of ours, 11.8%, and ours is 6.3%. And, of course, ours, both of those numbers are on the low side because they're only accounting, they're not counting the people that are underemployed or have given up looking for work. But the point is they're comparable because they're measured the same way. And so they have almost twice as much unemployment. They had another recession, a second recession that was longer than the first one, whereas we had only one recession that lasted about 18 months. And that's because, largely because of the difference between our Federal Reserve and the central bank of the Eurozone. And so so you have to look at both sides of it. I mean, it is, you know, an improvement over prior monetary policy. It's much better than what the other biggest economy in the world, namely the European Union, or if you want to just count the Eurozone, where the policy is being made for those countries. We're much better off having a central bank that was willing to do that. But again, we don't have, so I think Bernanke did the right thing. Well, the problem is we didn't have a Congress and executive that was willing to take that money and spend it on the things that this country really needs.
Well, he could have done a lot better with it. He could have put that money into infrastructure. He could put it into re-employing people to de-ghettoize America's cities. He could have done so much. In any case,
Bernanke himself can't do that. I mean, the Fed can't do that. All they can do is create the money. The Congress has to allocate, has to use that money in the budget.
Or those banks that come in financial institutions like Goldman Sachs, they got $884 billion. They could be told, put this money into the economy in a way that's constructive.
Oh, that's right. They could have put a lot of requirements on the banks when they bailed them out, and that was a major failure. But that, again, was a decision of our Congress and executive and not the Federal Reserve.
And we know where the Congress has been for a long time.
Yes.
Mark, thank you very much for being on. I really appreciate all the good work that you
Sure. And
Dean Baker, give my best to Dean Baker down there.
Okay,
doing
I will. Thanks, Gary.
Dr. Mark Weisbrot, and he is his website is cepr.net and justforeignpolicy.org. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment with part two. If you would like to call in now and share a responsible comment about the fate of Pacifica, the history of Pacifica, and BAI, opportunity to do so. I did not have a second in the 2 hours of my presentation last week. I was inundated with calls and information. People are coming out of the woodwork. And I said, why? Why haven't you spoken? Why haven't you gone to the news media with this information? They were afraid. Afraid of what? Afraid of whom? And you would be surprised at their answers. But then after I saw their documentation, I better understand their position. Please stay with us. Last week I mentioned some 21 separate programs that are aired not just on WBAI, our sister station in New York, but also originating from syndication or the other stations. And these in the current incarnation represent, at least from those I've listened to, the ones that would be exemplary on any station, commercial or non-commercial. And there are those programs, for example, on WBAI over the weekend, on the Saturday morning, James Irsay, on Friday, on Saturday morning, with the Broadway show, on the opera show. I don't care if you put those on the New York Times station. It would be as good as it gets. So that's the best the BAI and Pacifica can be, and historically has been. And so that's why I'm appreciative of the 38 years that I've been on Pacifica. Our issue is, what happens when you have mismanagement, malfeasance, poor programming, and a culture that seems antithetical to professional standards and creating a form across the board that serves the needs of the people today. Or another way of looking at it, if Lewis Hill was alive today, what would he select for the programs that he believes are needed by people today? And what should be the standards and the type of governance? Because one of my important points was that the governance structure it's just a mess. It is in constant gridlock, it's expensive, and I just believe it could not get any worse and must be completely changed. I also mentioned that you really need 6 people minimally to oversee a station. This is just to oversee it and to guide it. An outstanding program director selected not because their political alliance, but because of their competence knowing what the public wants, and then getting them the best people for that and holding those producers and hosts accountable. Number 2, to have a station manager that knows what it is to work with people of varying backgrounds, and a financial officer that sees that the money that comes in or goes out is brought in or spent in a way that is in balance with the station's needs, so that you keep in a positive cash flow. A developmental director that would help develop the entire station and its programming towards a sustainability. A premium director that would qualify each premium. And only by qualifying premiums do you know whether or not the premium, the book, the video, whatever it may be, is really of a quality, allowing no unsupported claims and allowing no counseling services a part of that. And when I start hearing of intuitives charging $700 for their time, and we think that somehow you're getting a deal if you buy so many classes, well, that's their right, but it's not something that I believe we should be offering. I believe that our premiums should be in alignment with each program's theme. And if you have a program selection and a fund drive selection, you're working months in advance so that there's a variety and not then overdoing it. And a human resources person, so you don't have all this bitterness and acrimony that exists. Those are just some of the things I believe that would stabilize and allow for a stronger station. But that's also true of any radio station. The fact is that out there where you're at in Los Angeles, you have KPCC 89.3 FM. The person who built that little station into the powerhouse it is today used to work at KPFK, I believe, as a program director. I can be wrong on that. And now, when you look at the tiny audience, almost flatlined audience at KPFK, and then you look at her audience of 700,000, well, you start to think, how is it that she's 700-800 times percent higher? It's because they're doing it right, and we're not. We do everything based upon self-serving interest and ideology, and that has brought us to ruin, even with good individual programming and noble individuals. Thank you. I appreciate your call, Ed. Now, I'm going to be interspersing some commentary. If anyone else would like to share their views, as long as they're constructive, happy to hear them. I'm sure that most people have the idea that the drugs are an inner-city problem, mainly among black and brown people. Not true. Today, according to Owen Poindexter of Alternet, the top users of heroin are white people in affluent suburbs. So then ask yourself, what does the typical heroin user look like? The answer has shifted in 50 years. According to a new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Psychiatry, in the 1960s, heroin was used predominantly by men in cities, usually in areas with large minority populations. They typically started in their late teens, and heroin was usually the first opiate they tried. Since then, the picture has changed. Now, heroin users start older, live in the suburbs, and are 90% white. The key to this shift is another finding by the same study. While the heroin users of previous decades had not previously used other opiates, heroin users of the last decade typically got their start on prescription drugs. Quote from the study, part of this increase in heroin use and apparent migration to the new class of users appears to be due to the coincidental increase in abuses of prescription opiates over the last 20 years, arguably accelerated by the release of OxyContin in the mid-1990s, which made large quantities of oxycodone hydrochloride readily available for inhalation and intravenous injection, end quote. Now, what seems to have happened is that thousands of people, mostly white suburbanites, got the taste of opiates from OxyContin, Percocet, and other prescription painkillers, and then simply shifted to the cheapest, most accessible source for their fix. Three-quarters of the roughly 2,800 people surveyed for the study said they tried prescription painkillers before heroin. Quote, there is now growing evidence that some prescription opiate users and abusers, particularly those who inhale or inject their drugs, graduate or shift to heroin at least in part because it has become more accessible and far less expensive than prescription opiates. And this pattern helps explain the sudden rise in heroin use in the United States. So after years of relative stability, heroin use rose in the last 5 years. A lot of regular users. And just 3 weeks ago, I spent a full day filming in Camden, New Jersey, and I saw a lot of drug users, lots of open drugs out in the street. And yet, one man was not unusual. I'm guesstimating him to be in his mid-50s. He was in very poor health, and he saw I was filming, and he said, what are you filming? I said, a documentary on what it means to be poor. He said, well, I'm poor. And I said, how poor are you? He said, well, I'm so poor that I used to live across the river in Philadelphia, but I couldn't afford the meds for my multiple injuries, and so I came over here because I heard how inexpensive pain-killing narcotics were that I could get on the street. And he said, it's true. He said, it's a lot more dangerous here. He said, I've been mugged 3 times in the last week. In the last week alone. And he lived on what was considered a good block. Not unusual. So instead of listening to the corporatized Democrat Republicans who with a knee-jerk reaction say, lock them up, why don't we try to be honest and say, why are so many people wanting a drug or any substance that can create addictive behavior to escape some reality? Are we so afraid to look at how unexceptional we are in our lives? Because people who are living in happiness and joy and contentment, they're not needing the drugs. So it's what we're not getting in the current behavioral model that we are living through. Our social contract has been undermined, perverted. So we're simply expected to distract ourselves, watch television, go buy something. The consequence is irrelevant. There will always be a drug. Why can't we just stop long enough to have an open, honest debate? Allow everyone out of jail was there because of drug use or possession, and start to help people deal with their more important foundational issues in life. For decades, we were told that the United States government, the CIA, the State Department, had nothing to do whatsoever with the 1970 problems in Chile with the Democratic elected President Salvador Allende. We lied. According to History News Network, quote, covert U.S. planning to block the Democratic election of Salvador Allende in Chile began weeks before his September 4, 1970 victory, according to just declassified minutes of an August 19, 1970 meeting of the high-level interagency committee known as the Special Review Group, chaired by National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger. quote, Kissinger asked that the plan be as precise as possible and include what orders would be given September 5th, to whom, and in what way. As the summary recorded Kissinger's instructions to CIA Director Richard Helms, quote, Kissinger said we should present to the president an action plan to prevent the Chilean Congress from ratifying an Allende victory, and noted that the president may decide to move even if we do not recommend it, end quote. The document is one of a compendium of 366 records released by the State Department as part of its Foreign Relations of the United States series. This much-delayed collection, titled Chile, 1969 to 1973, addresses Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger's efforts to destabilize the Democratic-elected socialist government and the U.S.-supported coup that brought General Augusto Pinochet to power in 1973. And keep in mind, by putting Pinochet in power, that in turn led to a reign of imprisonment, torture, and murder of tens of thousands of Chilean citizens. In addition, Henry Kissinger, in his roles as National Security Advisor, then Secretary of State, oversaw U.S. support for the heinous and barbaric Operation Condor. This was U.S.-approved backing of military governments in the Southern Cone nations of South America. The result was a murder spurge of anyone suspected of sympathizing with alternative economic systems to capitalism or even of populist governments that were run by the non-ruling elite. In Argentina, the unimaginable horrors included torturing pregnant women until they gave birth. After a woman delivered, she was killed and her child given up for adoption to military families. Argentina also flew regular flights over the Rio del Plata, during which suspected subversives were bound, drugged, and then dropped from high altitude into the water to drown. Many families in Chile still do not know the fate of the disappeared ones, who were often taken from their homes at night, never heard of again, estimated tortured and executed during Operation Condor, 50,000. So that is one more reason why we should hold all of those accountable to the same principles of jurisprudence and law, and bring Henry Kissinger and all the people involved at State Department, CIA, everyone involved, based upon the Nuremberg trials and the rules that occurred after that, there's no statute of limitation. I think we should do the same when it comes to the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, this is from Alex Kane from Alternet. Thought you would find this of interest. The article's entitled Endless War, Five Disturbing Things in America's Military Budget. Now, right now, by the way, it's Pentagon budget time, and once again, Congress and the White House are haggling over the fine print of the National Defense Authorization Act. But what has stayed constant over the years is the massive spending on the defense budget, which points to the American political establishment's appetite for militarism. Congress proposed Pentagon budget this year is $601 billion, a sum that dwarfs spending during the Vietnam War. There have been predictable howls from conservative lawmakers over some proposed cuts to the defense budget advocated by Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, and Congress has resisted the military's attempts to cut spending. But even if Hagel's cuts are implemented, the budget would still amount to $495 billion. That's not a paltry sum. The House of Representatives this month passed the $600 billion version of the National Defense Authorization Act. Now, the other night, someone said, watch Hannity. And I did, and there was a person arguing from this group of people who had that, you know, this administration is cutting the budget of our military, making us defenseless. Well, I don't know what figures this person is reviewing, but when you take a look at all of our defense online and offline, on book and dark financing, it's $1,500,000,000. That's a lot of money, and most of it is unaccounted for, going to private contractors. 60 Minutes on Sunday evening showed how there were one single jet project was 7 years past due and hundreds of billions of dollars over budget. No one complains about a system that is virtually not ready, and by the time it does get ready, we won't need it. We have hundreds of systems that are just antiquated. We have one audit found that 10 separate contractors were all given multi-billion dollar projects to work on the same identical thing. 10 different people doing the same thing. That is typical. Well, how does it get that way? This is an actual conversation that happened with the person at my last lecture in Washington, D.C. at the Civic Center a year and a half ago. After the lecture, which is huge, and I'm outside signing books, I saw him sitting there, and he waited till everyone else had their book signed, and I was ready to go. And he said, "I just want to share something with you." He said, "I listen every day on PFW. And he said, "You don't even know how bad it really is." He said, "Let me tell you how it actually works today." He said, "I won't tell you what part of this, but I'm in this scenario." He said, you work for a legislator. You work your way up until you're one of the top people for senator or house member. And you have a large Rolodex of all the people that give money. And depending upon where your boss, the legislator, sits, which panel committee sits on, banking, defense, security, agriculture, all the top people come and they give enormous amounts of money. But they also make side deals. Now, here's a typical side deal. You're playing racquetball. Why racquetball? Because there's no one going to record it and no one's stupid enough to put it in an email, which could be subpoenaed. And there's no phone record of it. It's just you played racquetball in the morning. But the person you're playing racquetball with happens to be with a major defense contractor. And they say, "What are you making now, about $100,000? Well, what if you made $500,000? Also, you had a leased car of your choice. You want a BMW, you want a Mercedes, you want a unlimited American Express card for expenses. You want to be able to use some of the perks, including occasionally the private jet. All that's possible. What do I have to do in return? Just see that our project gets green-lighted by the legislator." Now, there's total plausible deniability. No one's going to be held accountable. And then one day, this becomes a no-bid contract, and now millions or hundreds of millions, and in time possibly billions of dollars is going to a company that has former generals or procurement officers at the Pentagon or an admiral, a lot of top people on their advisory board to make them look all so good because everyone else has the same type of people. And then a person a year later quits the government service and goes in there. And that's just one scenario. Or they go for a big lobbying company. And one guy went to be a lobbyist and made $2 million a year guaranteed. This is after he helped pass the Medicare Act that Congress never saw, never wrote. It was all done by lobbyists and lawyers for the pharmaceutical industry. So he said, that's how everything in Washington works. Everything. Nothing is about what the people need. So think about that when you think about endless wars and the disturbing things in the American military budget. For example, more special forces. President Obama has wound down the Iraq war and plans to reduce troop levels in Afghanistan, though he's also attempting to negotiate a prolonged troop presence in the latter country. And at the same time, he has presided over an expansion of elite military units known as Special Operations Forces, which operate secretly around the globe and have become crucial to the endless war on terror. Special operation forces like the Navy SEALs are used to train foreign militaries in counterterrorism and execute raids like the operation that killed bin Laden. And that's just one way. Also, and that costs about an additional $7.7 billion. And then there's the drone war continuing, deploying special operations forces. Yeah, and then the drones. U.S.'s wage a relentless war via drone in Pakistan and Yemen, other countries, and just the addition of drones for this year was 120 million. Then just the whole idea of endless war. In 2001, the U.S. enshrined its into law the authorization for the use of military force. The measure has come to justify many aspects of war on terror, from Guantanamo to Afghanistan to drone strikes, and the House wants to keep it that way. Democrat Adam Schiff attempted to introduce an amendment that would have repealed this, but it was shot down. So we will have forever endless war. Also indefinite detention and missile defense for Israel. And that's an additional $600 million. So those are just some additional expenses that we, the public, pay. Now, the next time you ask, why is it we have 18 million hungry children? Why is it we have 100 million Americans living at, below, or near the poverty level? Why do we have 50 million people who have lost their homes? Well, it's because the largest single item in discretionary spending is defense. But we don't need $1.5 trillion being spent to defend us. We need about $200 billion. Everything else is just pure politics of greed and gaming the system. And that we should say no to. But we got to know it's being done before we can say no to it. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Source for the best in progressive radio.